Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too.
Say hi and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast on this really miserable afternoon, but we have a bright and sunny yellow background in front of me. So I have Dr. Anna Pitlovana with me. Would you like to say hello and a little bit about who you are and what's brought you on today?
Hi, thank you so much for having me today. Yes, my name is Dr. Anna Agnieszka Pitlovana. I go by Anna. I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm UK trained and based. And I have had an amazing opportunity through the Association of Clinical Psychologists UK, ACP for short, to author a book as part of a book series titled Coping With. And my book is titled Coping With Bereavement. And it very much brings my training and expertise and strategies and ideas that I incorporate into my practice alongside my lived experience of having had a significant family member die suddenly several years ago, which, I'd love to talk some more about as we get going.
So for people that may not be familiar with the Coping With series, or maybe if you're new to this podcast, I've had several other clinical psychologists on who've written books in this series. They're all coping with, and the thing that I absolutely love is that wonderful hybrid of clinical experience, you know, theory, rationale, but the most important thing, the lived experience as well, which I just think resonates with people so much. So that's why every single episode we've had has been so, so well received. But I will say, and it's really important to say, is also thank you for coming on, because you can be quite vulnerable sharing your story. When I first qualified, we were kind of taught not to share anything personal at all, whereas things have kind of moved on now, and as you know, actually it can be very helpful to share lived experience of things as long as it's appropriate in the context. Is it okay, how comfortable the lived experience bit is so important, how comfortable are you telling us a little bit about what led you to want to kind of write your journey down and your experience down in a book?
Yeah, no, absolutely, thank you for that question. I will contextualise my experience of bereavement to start with. My dad, who I was very close to, died in 2015. It was quite sudden. And I didn't realise until much later that I didn't really even have the language to talk about death and dying and what happens when that takes place in a family unit. You know, lots was at play at the time, me being in my mid-20s, working really hard to make it in terms of education and my career, and wanting to kind of, you know, function and to cope, and what on earth does that mean when one dies? And all of that alongside, you know, the identity of an immigrant and how I understood my culture of origin. I originate from Poland. You know, those ideas about being actually quite stoic and keeping emotions at home behind closed doors, and showing up at work and actually cracking on and functioning as though everything is fine. All of that meant that I ended up silencing my experience of what was going on for me at the time for a long while. And so one of the reasons why I wrote the book was to give my younger self an opportunity to be heard. The more important part of it, though, is, you know, what I do professionally. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've always wanted to be in a helping profession. I've always wanted to have this privilege and amazing opportunity to contribute to people's quality of life. And thinking back on how hard it was for me at the time and how little I knew about bereavement, death, the language around it, I really felt the need to give back to others, to create something that I feel I could have really benefited from at the time when it was all happening.
Is it all right to ask? And so kind of two things come to mind to me, the kind of looking at coping and the kind of helpful or maybe less helpful, really compassionate, that we all can get kind of caught up in things we think might help at a time in our lives, but end up maybe not being the best thing. But also language there that you picked up on, because it's interesting that this book is using the term bereavement and not grief, which is something I find quite interesting in terms of we do see the word grief a lot. What led you to use the word bereavement rather than grief?
Yeah, very interesting question. I did think about this quite a lot, and I do find that those terms tend to be used interchangeably. And actually, there's a difference. I see a difference there. So for any of the listeners, if you're curious to discover all the emotions according to the research that a human being is capable of experiencing, if you type in the wheel of emotions, you'll find a visual representation, and you'll see that grief is one of those emotions. Bereavement, on the other hand, as I think about it, is the process. It's the journey. It's how we respond. And what's really helpful for me in conceptualizing it that way is just giving myself and hopefully the readers the permission to see it as an ongoing journey, a journey that doesn't have a fix, that doesn't suddenly disappear, you know, it isn't something that we're able to completely forget about. It's something that we continue to walk and navigate. And it includes all sorts of emotions, grief being one of them. You know, I certainly experienced anger, anxiety, fear about my own mortality. You know, of course, sadness. I experienced relief in terms of how my dad's death happened. And that's a tricky emotion to talk about as well when it comes to coping with bereavement. But that was the thinking behind the title of the book, that the book is about coping with the process of bereavement. And within the book, you will see that grief is one of the emotions that I discuss.
Because I'm really interested that when I qualified, there was only kind of one main model of how you would look at bereavement. And I used to struggle because I'd have a lot of clients who used to come and say, I'm stuck in this phase, that's this phase. I haven't gone through this phase. Why have I gone back to this phase? And it almost was guiding their journey rather than themselves organically going through a process. So I know maybe that's something we can come on to talk about, that there are different models, which I find much more compassionate, much more realistic in terms of how we face life again after loss. Is it all right to just dip back into your own personal experience? Because I think this will resonate with so many people listening. The kind of ways that we cope, because that really struck me when you were just saying that sometimes we might cope in ways that are fairly, I'm being really compassionate with my language, you know, more helpful ways and maybe less of coping, and how we identify what those are.
Absolutely. And I think compassion and self-compassion is so important in all of that, especially when reflecting on what was and how we were trying to cope and what we know now. And when I was writing my book, that I found myself needing to lean on self-compassion a lot, because some of the things that I describe in terms of how I tried to cope in the immediacy of my dad's death was through avoidance, was through over-exercising, was through not telling people in my life that he died, was to show up at work and not say that I've had that significant, you know, life changing event happen in my life. And that is something to learn from, and I think it's so human to want to move away from distress and to want to insist on behaving as though life is carrying just fine. And I think it's so important for me to be able to name the fact that that's also how I was coping at the time, alongside all the more, if you like, sophisticated, psychologically informed ideas that I discuss in the book, and offer very tangible, accessible worksheets and frameworks around for people to go away and try.
That's what I love. So I want to bring that in too, that sometimes as a mental health professional or somebody in the wellbeing sector, there can be a kind of presumption that the knowledge you have about the job you do will also be translated to your everyday life. And that isn't the case. I love the fact, I hope this is okay to say, that as a psychologist, you can be vulnerable and say, we all just cope in the way that we know or with the resources that we have. And I think that will resonate with so many, because sometimes there can be guilt and shame over the way we cope, or we might be, and that may be in, you know, from our own kind of analysis of the situation, but also externally, you know, people saying, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you crying? Why aren't you taking time off work? And it can be quite hard to navigate that. So I really appreciate that you can kind of share that. When we kind of think about, I love that's a really accessible description as well, of kind of bereavement being the process and grief being one of the emotions, because sometimes people don't know. I do a lot of work in a sector where grief is quite hidden, and people will notice things like stress, anger, frustration, things that can also be present when someone's experiencing loss. Is it all right to, I want to kind of bring in kind of biopsychosocial elements. People might not be familiar with that is, but I think it's so important, because that's quite an inherent part of your book, isn't it? Is we don't just experience grief as this one thing. As you just said, you were living a life, you had things that you had to get on with after you lost your dad. How can the kind of biopsychosocial theory or model help us in understanding bereavement?
So that was so important for me to think about in terms of my own meaning making of my experience, yes, and also for the reader, really thinking about, you know, the psychological component. So thinking about the emotions, our emotional health, our thoughts, our beliefs, our rules for living, what we might default to in terms of how we treat ourselves, how we see other people, and how we see the world. There's absolutely the social aspect of bereavement and and death and dying. And what I found myself reflecting on a lot was, you know, how in many Western societies, and maybe I should make it specific to the UK context, where I was navigating the initial stages of my bereavement, ideas around compassionate leave and how on earth do you calculate how many days off one should have depending on the relationship to the deceased. You know, it just brings up so much around productivity and showing up and what we mean by resilience, what we mean about strength.
Absolutely.
So thinking from a social aspect about how we walk the path of bereavement is incredibly relevant. And I am trained to think about human beings, and I have my personal values that agree with that as well. As social species, we need connection, we need to gather, we need rituals, we need traditions to be able to process significant life events. So it is absolutely a social experience when bereavement touches us, and something that isn't always made space for by the society within which we might find ourselves in. And then the biological aspect is absolutely huge. You know, there is this, sadly, and I think things are improving, but there continues to be, I think, this divide between physical health and mental health. You know, it's either that there is something wrong with your body, and you see someone who's trained in the physical health side of things, or it's all in your head, and you need to see someone to deal with mental health about it. And my answer has always been, my head is part of my body. It's all one thing,
literally
all connected. So if I am going through such a significant and challenging psychological and social process, of course my body is going to respond to that on a biological or physical health level. And the research is clear that our cardiac health, our immune system, our digestion, our gut health, all of that is affected by significant life events such as bereavement. And it was incredibly validating for me, and again, I really hope that it will be the same for my readers, to really know that that's a thing. And I reflect in the book on feeling incredibly weak, struggling to concentrate, you know, appetite went out the window, sleep went out the window. I had aches and pains, you know, I felt really heavy, zero energy. All of that is, you know, this is physical health. And it's so important to seek support around that. Right. Well, maybe I need a blood test. Maybe I need to tell my GP that this is happening in my life. Maybe I need to look at my diet slightly differently in order to look after the biological side of the biopsychosocial understanding of the process and the journey of bereavement.
It's so interesting. All of those elements are important in terms of how we function. So if you're doing a job and you are feeling, how do you focus when you have a caseload? So if we take the job that we do, you know, you're processing and holding, weighing up information all the time. You're having to be really careful around risk. It's quite physically demanding if you're going around the community, is, you know, all of that. And then sometimes you have other stuff. Oh, we might be parenting, we might be helping other relatives, we might be volunteering, you know, all of the things. And I think, do you know what? It's one of those things, again, I have these moments on this podcast where I go, it sounds so obvious, but you hear it and go, gosh, you know, how many people hopefully are listening to this going, I've never realized, even if they're supporting someone else with bereavement as well, to check in with how their body's doing and what they need, and not to have these very distinct pathways. I think that will resonate with a lot of people. And that's kind of a thread through your book as well, isn't it? That I quite like the fact that people don't have kind of, we must work on our physical health in this way and our mental health in this way. So they're talking about the two things, that there's no overlap. Because sometimes people need a bit of support to know how to know what's what, don't they? Are there any, you know, when we look at how we cope with grief, obviously we could probably do endless podcast episodes on this. What are your kind of key, I don't want to spoil the book because I want people to buy it and read it and use it. So we don't want any too many giveaways, but, you know, when we kind of think about, there's different types of loss that we might have as well. So there's bereavement through death, but death can occur in different ways, and there can be different journeys to that. There can be anticipatory grief. There may be more complex stuff. We may have lost someone due to suicide. We may have lost someone, but the relationship with that person was tricky. There may have been trauma involved, for example. Is how do we start to think about those things? That's a big, bold question, isn't it?
It really is. And I think everything that you named there, I touch on the book. So there are obviously several chapters and several areas. And I think there are lots of similarities in all those different kind of contexts or examples of situations where someone might be touched by bereavement. And there are also differences. And there are also individual differences.
I'm so hoping you're going to say that. Yeah.
And a lot of the strategies and the worksheets that I offer within the book allow the reader to gradually get to know their own process, their own journey, their own sense making, their own emotions, their own thoughts, their own toolkits that they already have available to them that are under the belts in terms of how have I navigated adversity in the past.
Yeah.
What's relevant here? So I wouldn't want to be too prescriptive around here are the ways to manage that, because it needs to be incredibly person-centered and individualized to what's going on for that particular individual in question. Yet again, like I say, the key takeaway for me has been get to know your own experience, really lean into it, really examine it, really sit with it to be able to navigate it.
Because that, I was really hoping you're going to bring that in, because some, you know, there are commonalities in how something may present. So we, you know, most people that lose someone, there will be something they'll have in common, their experience, their emotions, how they're coping. But the problem is sometimes that one size fit all model can be applied, can't it? So, you know, I remember once having a bereavement many, many years ago, and I was in the NHS actually, and a colleague at the same time had, but we had very different journeys. But what happens if you get compared, you know, well, that person's back at work before you, or that person's managing their caseload, or is sometimes there can be a little bit of guilt and shame then in how we're coping. So what I love about your book is it's stripping it, that's very psychology, isn't it? Stripping it back to going, right, who am I? What is my experience of loss? So what do we know about loss? What do we know about grief? What do we know about bereavement? Educating people around those terms, but then being okay that your range of emotions may be very different to someone else's, your pathway. And that to me is worth its weight in gold, because I do think some people really struggle and maybe have more complex journeys because they are trying to fit themselves, is that all right to say, into this kind of mold of how they should cope. You know, I should have done this by now. I should be back at work by now. I shouldn't be crying every day by now. And there's almost these like benchmarks, aren't there? And I guess that brings us back to kind of models and how we see grief in the modern day as well.
Yes, no, absolutely. So much there that you touched on, Tara, that's so relevant. And I think that comparison is so real, and I go back to these ideas around compassionate grief and how much yes. time you are given, and yeah. then you come back to work and yeah. there are these unspoken expectations or pressures to show yes. up in a certain way. Yes. And I think, so for me, the five stages model from Kubler-Ross
yes.
was incredibly important. And it was for our profession and for sense-making, because you have to start somewhere in order to be able yes. to describe and research and develop the understanding of a concept. Yeah. We know now that the dual model of yes. bereavement has a kind of very well supported evidence base, and what it suggests, which I think is so normalizing and so validating and so compassionate, is that we will move between, we'll oscillate between the position of really leaning into everything that is so emotional and so challenging that's related to the death in question, yes. and then we'll move away from that into what they call restoration, i.e. yes. throwing ourselves into our day-to-day, you know, doing the shopping, cooking for our family, maybe even smiling and laughing. And there can yeah. be both guilt and shame about that yeah. as well.
So
you
know,
how come I've just managed to forget for a split second that this has happened? Or actually yes. we know from science that our nervous system needs that respite, needs yes. those breaks to be able to carry on, to be able to function. And how far we swing between those two positions on that spectrum, if you like, is highly individualized as well. Yeah. And yeah. once again, I find it so compassionate, so validating, yeah. and so appropriately flexible in how we understand and conceptualize anyone's response to their particular bereavement.
I particularly love that model, because I think it also helps not only, I've had personal experience the last year of grief, bereavement is just kind of looking at how other people may treat you, that that's okay. We've all, it's what's lovely, isn't it? You can kind of bring in these examples and share, is just the kind of invalidation you might get from people if you're seen to be enjoying something or you've managed to cook dinner. Because sometimes there can be a little bit of, I guess we kind of call it cognitive bias, maybe, of, you know, well, if you're doing those things, you must be doing okay. And then you can have days where you're almost kind of crippled or debilitated, you know, literally you can't do anything, can't function. And I actually found that really compassionate for my own journey, but also to help navigate other people's kind of expectations and comments as well. And I think that will resonate with a lot of people, because we're all so different. And that brings me on to my kind of next question, is that, you know, depending on your age, your gender, your culture, there's so much that will impact how you experience bereavement, how you work through bereavement, isn't there? And how have you brought that in to your book and your work?
Again, wonderful and such a relevant question. So I really thought about the idea of social graces. It's yes. an acronym, and it's essentially yeah. a list of all the different ways in which we can describe ourselves and situate ourselves within the society that we're in through those yeah. different descriptors. Another concept that overlaps with this very closely is cross-sectionality. Again, those ideas around, you know, okay, what's my ethnicity? What's my gender? What's my age? What's my ability? What's my accent? What's my religion? What's my sexuality? And how all of that might interact, right? And that's relevant when we think about
absolutely.
any life experiences, right? And especially when we're psychologists, we really want to understand, okay, what is your individual story yes. of this? Yeah. And how can we draw on that understanding to be able to offer something helpful here? And it's crucial to do that when it comes to navigating bereavement. And it was incredibly crucial and continues to be for me. Yes. And that's, you know, so I was 26 at the time. I was quite junior in my career. I was an immigrant. I'm of Polish background. You know, I was getting used to living in a very busy yeah. city of London, understanding what the culture there was, what was appropriate, what was not. I was navigating questions around religion, spirituality, you know, what my context of origin was and how it was understood yes. where I was living at yeah. the time.
Yeah.
And then I was faced with my dad's death, and all of that was very relevant in navigating that. And at the time, I wasn't really allowing myself to think about those different layers of my identity. And I've learned a lot from that. And again, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to have written this book, because it means that I can give this insight and knowledge to my readers, yes. where they can really pause and think about, okay, how is my culture, age, religion, geography, and ability relevant here? You know, what's getting in the way of me being able to navigate my grief, my bereavement, rather, grief being one of those emotions there, and what is facilitating it? So for me, you know, whilst at the time I think I was working really hard to integrate and to be seen as very similar to everyone else,
and I
wasn't religious at that point, and I am not, I found myself going to a parish church in London to really sit with that familiarity that was yes. part of my upbringing. And you know, funerals, death, funerals, religion, rituals, traditions, all of that was part of how my family were walking yes. that path. And so yes. I decided to think about that descriptor of my identity and to lean into it to facilitate some processing of the emotions that were coming up for me at the time.
So one thing I've just picked up in there is we both use the word processing throughout this podcast. Somebody maybe totally new or suddenly just stumbled across this podcast and does, why is it important to process? Because a lot of the things that we've talked about, a lot of the strategies are about kind of processing. And I wonder whether some listeners may go, I wonder what that means. Or, you know,
what does that mean?
Yes. Why is it useful?
For me, the idea of coping and that dual model really links to making space for what is.
Yes.
And sitting with and connecting with and owning it. You know, the five stages, I think, runs the risk of lineal improvement. You keep getting better and better and better.
Absolutely, yeah.
And function better and better and achieve more and more. Where actually coping and processing is about being able to notice, name, sit with and connect through what's happening for us in the moment.
Yeah.
And that's what I see as coping. And that's what I see as resilience. And I realize there are different schools of thought when it comes to that word. Yeah. And I'm all over that because I'm really interested in the power of language, particularly being multilingual, you know,
words. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
Carry power. And there are different interpretations of what we mean by things. By coping and processing, I really mean noticing, naming, sitting with, and connecting through the authenticity of every moment of that path of bereavement.
Which is interesting, actually. So when you were talking about your own personal journey, and that will resonate, certainly resonates with me, and I'm sure with a lot of people listening, is that sometimes when we are very overwhelmed with a situation, adverse situation, big emotions, thoughts, whatever, we can pull away and avoid. That's where sometimes then stuff can sit, and that's what we mean by not processing it. So we're kind of moving away from everything you said there, leaning in, making room for it, which isn't about kind of necessarily ticking a box and as you say, moving through and getting better. It's just about making some of those emotions a little bit more tolerable, being able to have a little bit more connection with self and also value-based living again, and just being compassionate and being able to notice when we might be pulling away, you know, physically or emotionally from things. And I think that's actually a really helpful descriptor that I'm glad you brought in resilience as well, though, actually, because sometimes I notice that word can be used in a way in terms of you're not resilient rather than how are we building up resilience. I guess I when I first qualified, resilience was used in a different way. And I love that idea that so far through this podcast, it's been very compassionate, very much about the individual's needs, noticing what you need, what you're experiencing, and being okay with what your particular, I'm going to use the word journey, is that all right? But, you know, what your process is like, what your journey is like. And I think actually that will resonate with so many people. We're in a very tick box, quick fix culture at the moment, aren't we? Especially with mental health and emotional health. And I wonder whether with the kind of stages model that we had, right, I've done anger, right, I've done denial, I've done this, I've done that, you know, I'm okay now. And actually that's, for a lot of people, it's just pushing stuff down, isn't it?
Absolutely. And yet again, that kind of dynamic, flexible, permissive nature of the dual model, where we move between and we're constantly somewhere on that spectrum between being fully in all the strong emotions related to the death that we're navigating, and then we're fully into, oh my goodness, I've got this amazing trip coming up and I've just really smiled about it, and that's okay too. And similarly to that, you know, noticing where we're at any particular moment is that opportunity to be able to do something about it. So I know that my earliest go-to, if you like, when facing challenges is to move away, is to avoid. And if I can notice that, then it can be moving away in order to come back and move closer. The key is in noticing where I'm at various points and doing that in a self-compassionate and psychologically aware way. And once again, you know, lots of the worksheets that I offer in the book really lend themselves really well to that. Just really make space, sit down, be with yourself, grab a pen, let's try to understand where you're at right now.
And that language is just so compassionate as well, isn't it? You know, because sometimes there's so much guilt and shame in terms of I shouldn't be doing this. And some people might notice that they're pulling away, and then immediately you've got that kind of part of the brain going, I'm not coping, I shouldn't be doing this. But I really love actually what you said there about actually it's just sometimes just being a mindful or curious observer of what's going on. And that actually in itself might lead me back to where I need to be longer term. But sometimes we do avoid. Sometimes I always say we're all humans, and you know, we need to be compassionate with how we respond to stuff, don't we? For you particularly, because the thing that struck me is you're in the helping professions. Sometimes when we're helping others for a living, we are taking on a lot of stuff. But also then what happens if you're experiencing loss, if you're going through bereavement and you're in the helping professions? Because I know that's something that you cover, and that really struck me. And I think that will literally be resonating with a lot of people that are professionals listening to this, maybe in the view of helping their kind of clients as well.
I really hope so. And, you know, you say that, I mean, a helping profession for a living, but many of us have been in helping professions prior to that becoming our job. So we might have a very well established pattern of being with other people where we give a lot of ourselves. And it's incredibly rewarding. It's it's such a privileged position to be in. It can make it harder to receive if we're so used to our status quo being giving. And I dedicate an entire chapter to that. Because one, I'm clear from research and science out there that there is that high percentage of individuals in helping professions who do struggle to receive help, including when navigating bereavement. And partly because I really struggled. And that's something that's an ongoing journey for me. And I found, you know, 10 years on, a 11 years on nearly since my dad died, I have managed to really reflect in depth on what that experience means for how I practice as a psychologist, how I view myself in the therapy room, how I view my clients and their humanity, and also how I navigate my personal life, how I look after myself, how I strike the work-life balance, how I see my mortality and those around me. There's so much there that I've really, really gained from all those reflections. And I give that back to the reader once again. And I use a metaphor. I refer to kintsugi, which is the Japanese art of being able to bring parts of lovely creations that have been broken through the golden glue.
I love that.
More unique.
Absolutely love it.
To make them even more special. Yeah. And I offer a series of reflective questions. You know, what is in your kintsugi glue? What's here now that wasn't there before? What are you prepared to say yes and no to at work that you weren't prior to your bereavement? And some ideas around post-traumatic growth come in.
That's just what came to mind.
It's quite a thing to be in a helping profession and to be in need, clearly in need of help and support and connection from others, more so than at other times, if you like.
So actually, because the thing that strikes me about this podcast, but also your book, is actually, I think it's, some people may think, oh, if it's a book about a certain topic, it's for people who are experiencing that or have done. But actually, how many emotional health professionals, talking therapists, will also benefit from reading it as well? Because I, as a psychologist, I love to develop, I love to learn new things, but also it's the practice and the dynamics as well. And I actually think your book is super helpful for that as well. There are going to be people going, where do we find you then? So number one, how do we find your book? Because it's out soon, which is super exciting. Where can we grab a copy? And I'll put all of this in the show notes as well.
Wonderful. Yes. So the book will be out on the 10th of April, so next month. And it can be found on Routledge's website. So that's the publishing house that it's been put out there through. You can also find me on mindformind.co.uk. That's the website of my practice. And there is a link to the book and where you can buy it from there as well. So it will be out there very soon. Very exciting.
So excited. And you can pre-order, is that right, as well? So we can put it.
Yes, it's already available for pre-order. And I understand at the moment, I think there's a slight discount on it as well, because it was World Book Day not long ago. So
get in there quick.
A bargain, now is the time to do that.
I need to as well. Do you have socials? Where do you hang out if people want to find out more about you and any other bits of work you do?
Yes. So again, you've got my website, and I am also on Instagram and LinkedIn. Instagram, I suppose, is quite accessible. So it's mindfulmind_psychologist. And if you Google my name, Anna Pitlovana, will probably come up on Instagram as well. And that is the place where I also make what I have learned and what I continue to learn accessible to anyone out there, to for them to be able to take that away and to try out in
find
their
and
own
follow
lives, hopefully benefit themselves.
Sometimes just those little small nuggets on Instagram are enough for people to kind of go, hang on, this is me, and then go find your book. I always ask every guest, we've had loads and loads, but if there was one additional little takeaway that you could give us, one adversity takeaway, what would it be? One little thought or reflection?
Wow. I really want to be greedy and leave you with two, if I can.
I'll let you have
one
two.
Is, thank you.
It's one, the end of the day, so leave us with two.
Thanks, Tara. So I am a broken record in the book in saying there is no right or wrong way of walking your path of grief and bereavement. No right or wrong way of walking the path of bereavement. And the other takeaway or gift that I'd like to leave you and your listeners with is a wonderful quote which goes as follows: bereavement is as individual as the fingerprint
Wow.
Bereavement is as individual as your fingerprint. So there are no two people on the planet with the exact same fingerprint pattern. And the same applies to our journey of bereavement.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. That is like almost the perfect way to end. Thank you so much for coming on. It's really lovely to put a face to the name. So people are listening on Spotify, Amazon, Apple. You can also watch it visually on YouTube and our social medias as well, because I always think it's nice to put a face to a name as well. So thank you. I know, because you have a really busy schedule. It's the end of the working day and you've made time to come on. So thank you so, so much. And I can't wait to see your book get out there and see how you reach people. So thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much, Tara, for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.